Montana's home prices are rising. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capital reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry tells us about a big private donation to aid search and rescue in the Flathead. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with environmental historian Thomas Andrews about our complicated relationships with animals. Montana's median home values are climbing. That's according to statistics released today by the U.S. Census Bureau. The state's median home cost jumped 5% in the 3 years following the Great Recession. Capital reporter Dan Boyce tells us the nationwide median home price fell about 9% in the same period of time.
To emphasize, we're talking about the median home price in the state, not the average price. That means if we arrange 100 houses by price, the median is the price of the 50th house. It's considered less skewed than if you took the average of the prices, which might be thrown off if houses at the top end are really, really expensive or those at the bottom are really cheap. So this Census Bureau data looks at homes in the state's nine most populous counties. It says the price of Montana's median house in those counties went up 5% in the years 2010 through 2012. That's compared to the years of the Great Recession, 2007 through 2009. 5% means the house price jumped from just under $175,000 to under $184,000. This four-bedroom house outside of Helena sits well above that median price.
What is the price of this house, the asking price?
$375,000.
I'm talking to real estate broker Alan Bach. It is a beautiful home. Lots of skylights, a big kitchen.
Great views all the way around.
Tall, heated barn outside. Bach says he hasn't really seen homes in this price range get more expensive the last couple years. But Helena Homes near the median, there's been a lot of activity there from about $189,000 during the recession.
I've seen that 180 price range move up to 200 and maybe 220.
Lewis and Clark County saw 7% growth in the median home price. The biggest growth was Lake County at almost 14%. This median home price growth was not universal, though. If you look at the counties individually, Missoula, Ravalli, Flathead, and Gallatin counties saw median home prices fall. Flathead's price, for instance, fell by 7.5%. Northwest Montana Association of Realtors President Bill Leininger says the Flathead was affected by a high number of foreclosures and short sales coming onto the market in the wake of the recession.
So that definitely then brings down the market for everybody else that was trying to sell their homes at that time.
That's also part of what led to the national decrease in median home price. The Montana Department of Commerce says higher home prices can be a double-edged sword. They can price some people out of the market, but Commerce Department senior economist Joe Ramler says overall it's seen as a positive.
People generally buy homes in the expectation that the value that they're spending today is going to be less than hopefully future values. So you now have an asset instead of a liability.
Helena broker Alan Bach calls today's market in his area balanced. In the early 2000s, it was more of a seller's market.
Then after the dip, it was definitely a buyer's market for a while. And now I think it's kind of evened out, which is healthy for everyone, I think.
I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, a spokesman for the Roman Catholic Diocese of Helena says the diocese is dropping its group health insurance plans for 200 employees in parishes, schools, and social services across western Montana. Dan Bartleson says diocese officials will help those workers find individual insurance coverage on the marketplace and compensate them. Bartleson says the diocese is making the change because of increased costs of the nation's new health care law. He says premiums are going up when the cost of care per employee already is expensive because of the number of elderly and retired clergy. The diocese is also defending itself against lawsuits filed by hundreds of plaintiffs who claim they were sexually abused as children by clergy. Bartleson says the uncertainty has caused the diocese to be conservative in its financial planning.
Former Democratic Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer will speak next month at a liberal advocacy group event in Iowa. Schweitzer will give the keynote address December 18th at the 2013 Progress Iowa Holiday Party in Altoona. Schweitzer served two terms as Montana governor from 2005 through early 2013. He was recently elected board chairman of Stillwater Mining Company, Montana's largest publicly traded company. He decided against running for the open Senate seat vacated by Max Baucus, but is considered a possible Democratic candidate for president in 2016. In a press release, Schweitzer says he's excited to visit Iowa to talk about, quote, progressive values, end quote. Iowa is a key stop for presidential hopefuls. Vice President Joe Biden visited Iowa in September, and a number of potential Republican presidential candidates have held Iowa events.
Finding lost hunters, avalanche victims, missing snowmobilers, and injured hikers are among the search and rescue missions that happen every year in every season in western Montana. The Flathead, like many other communities, has these efforts coordinated through the county sheriff's department with many volunteers to aid search efforts. Getting to the lost or injured, especially in the rough mountainous terrain where recreation takes place, represents a challenge to search and rescue operations. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more on how a public-private partnership with a focus on flight is addressing that challenge.
It took private investment of more than $10 million to create Two Bear Air, a dedicated search and rescue air support service in the Flathead. Former Flathead County Undersheriff Jordan White teamed up with Whitefish philanthropist Mike Gogan to create the nonprofit. Gogan comes from a business background with a capital investment firm known for its support of entities like Google and YouTube. Paying for Two Bear Air is one of several philanthropic investments he's made in the Flathead. White describes the organization as privately funded for a public purpose.
This philosophy of providing the right equipment, regardless of what some of the costs may be, but doing it for all the right reasons to save a life is something that most agencies or organizations don't have the luxury of.
The Flathead County Sheriff's Department coordinates most search and rescue operations in the greater Flathead. White is now the executive director of Two Bear Air, but as the undersheriff, he had coordinated search and rescue efforts for the department. He says prior to Two Bear Air, they would coordinate with local pilots and with the Alert Medical Helicopter out of Kalispell's hospital when needed and possible. But they didn't have the money to pay for air support.
So it was realizing the benefit of having aircraft available to support our operations, but not having any way to pay for it, that sort of became a passion of mine to find a solution for.
White says he put himself through flight school and bought his own aircraft to try to address this problem.
In doing those things on my own, just because I was extremely passionate about not losing another life that didn't need to be lost, just because we didn't have the correct access or all the tools available to us.
White began working with Gogan, and they created Two Bear Air 2 years ago. The nonprofit just brought a Bell 429 helicopter online. It's outfitted with night vision in the cockpit and a hoist.
Yeah, it's a big winch, and that's all this is. It's mounted on the right side of the aircraft up high. It has hydraulic features, essentially motorized features that allow the camera that's mounted on the hoist and the hoist to be pivoted away from the aircraft.
White says short haul was frequently the only option without the hoist. Short haul involves attaching a rope to the bottom of the helicopter with a litter at the end for carrying a person or supplies. White says the Federal Aviation Administration frowns on the practice because of the dangers involved. The hoist allows them to lower people down and lift them back into the helicopter in places they can't land, like steep, rocky mountainsides.
The Rocky Mountains and Glacier Park specifically are areas where people are drawn to those peaks and those ridges and really challenge themselves physically and mentally to experience everything that Montana offers. So being able to get into those areas is key.
The new helicopter also has a basketball-sized black appendage under the nose that contains a number of cameras, including one that looks for differences in heat.
When we get out of a residential area or even town where there's cars and people and things, we get into a mountainous terrain. We're really the only things that produce large amounts of heat, especially in the fall, spring, and winter, are either animals or people. So it allows us to take a fairly large area and search that with a camera and see below the canopy.
White says air support and search and rescue can cut days into minutes when it comes to reaching the hard-to-reach backcountry.
But usually it's the folks that have been out already for a day or two by the time we get called and get in there to get them that realize how much trouble they're in and know right away that everything's going to be okay when they hear the helicopter. And those are real gratifying missions to be involved in.
The goal of the organization is to save time and energy and ultimately lives. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
The Montana Farm Bureau has dropped out of a lawsuit that seeks to block bison from roaming outside Yellowstone National Park. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports that the Montana Supreme Court dismissed the Farm Bureau from the case yesterday. The move leaves Park County as the only remaining plaintiff in a 2011 lawsuit that sought to keep bison out of the 70,000-acre Gardner Basin. A pending appeal in the case challenges a January ruling by State District Judge E. Wayne Phillips. He sided with state officials who lifted restrictions on bison movements that had been in place for decades. That's helped curb the periodic slaughter of hundreds of migrating bison. The plaintiffs have argued bison outside the park are a public safety threat and could spread disease to livestock.
Weather forecasters have backed off earlier predictions of strong winds and bitter cold weekend temperatures. Now, they say many of us could see some significant snow this weekend. Missoula area National Weather Service meteorologist Jeff Kitzmiller says an interesting and complex system is heading our way.
Starting in the west, our Idaho portions of our over in north central Idaho, up and through northwest Montana, Lookout Pass, up and even into like Knox and Libby area, could see some pretty good snow starting as early as tomorrow afternoon. As the system continues through, we'll see snow expand pretty much everywhere, and then we will see a little bit of wind along the divide as some of that cold air backs up against the terrain.
There will be several chances for snow. In the Missoula area, it's likely to start flying tomorrow night, and it could snow all day on Sunday.
The areas that are probably going to get the most up in northwest Montana will probably see lower elevations, somewhere around like 6 inches. Maybe not that much in Kalispell right now because they may still get a little bit of wind. And then if we work our way down to Missoula, right now we have about 3 inches in. And it'll probably be a little sporadic around here from the Bitterroot Valley up through the Missoula Valley just because we're looking like we'll probably see some snow bands like we've talked about in the past. So some people could actually see a fair amount of snow, and other people maybe a little lighter, you know, that 1 to 2 inch range. And then, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if someone came in and said they had 6 inches by late Sunday.
Kitzmiller says there's a fairly good chance one of those snow bands could move right over Missoula.
We might have them a little bit north of Missoula as well and then a little bit south. So there's just some places that are a little bit better to usually get them. But yeah, right now I'm seeing a pretty good potential for right in Missoula to see a band of snow.
This could affect weekend travel plans.
You know, we're thinking there could be some pretty big impacts on travel. Mountain passes, they might have trouble keeping up with the snow up there. So snow-covered roads, reduced visibilities, those will be a big deal. At the lower elevations, we might actually see more of ice forming and then snow because we are still kind of warm and our subsurface temperatures are warm. Snow is initially going to melt on roadways, so it could be a pretty big impact to travel this week, and actually we're going to say it is going to be a big impact to travel.
Kitzmiller says most of the I-90 corridor could get snow-covered roads, icy spots too. Don't expect bitter cold Arctic temperatures, but highs this weekend will probably top out in the 30s, a good 10 to 20 degrees cooler than this week's average temperatures. Overnight lows should be in the 20s, but when the system moves out of the area by Sunday night, skies could clear and temperatures drop a bit. It'll probably warm back up by Tuesday or Wednesday. We'll have more on weather later on in this broadcast.
University of Colorado historian Thomas Andrews' first book on Colorado coal miners won the prestigious Bancroft Award and also led him to the topic of his second book, with the grandiose title, An Animal's History of the United States. The environmental historian is still researching the book and is in Missoula to lecture about his research into the history of human and animal interactions. In this feature interview, Andrews talks with news director Sally Mock about the contradictory relationship with animals. He says, for example, Colorado coal miners had a contentious relationship with mules and an affectionate one with mice.
Basically sort of treated them like pets. And they named them and started sharing food with them and that kind of thing. And they did this, you know, probably...
Out of loneliness or boredom in the...
Well, partly, yeah. Partly, I think this was, you know, I mean, a lot of coal miners in that part of the world had sort of agricultural backgrounds, and I think they were sort of used to having animals in their lives. And so having other living creatures in the mines did sort of, you know, fulfill emotional needs. But at the same time, these mice actually fulfilled roles similar to canaries in coal mines. So mice had two advantages. One is that mice are really sensitive to the sort of micro cracking that would precede larger falls of coal from the roof or from the face in the mines. And so so miners, you know, they enjoyed these mice, but they also kept their eyes on them as they were working. If the mice scurried away, that was bad. The other thing that these mice were very sensitive to, of course, was carbon monoxide. And so if you were working in a, you know, in an underground chamber and the mice in there keeled over, it was one of the only ways in which these miners could actually tell that there was carbon monoxide creeping into their rooms.
They had less affectionate relationship with the mules.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The relationships between drivers and mules were very contentious. And, you know, and there's a whole sort of story of back and forth. You know, I mean, these mules really were famously stubborn. And the men who had to work with them all day often had their hands full. But at the same time, you know, I mean, they would sort of have their favorites and would develop quite affectionate relationships with some mules. But then they compared other mules sometimes to, you know, one mine worker called them bulky women. And in one of the most interesting interviews, a miner said that the mules were unionized before we were. And so there was this sort of sense then that the mules had kind of human-like qualities. And so, it was really that section of killing for coal that got me thinking about human-animal relationships in different ways. And so, you know, I did what a lot of professors do when we see a little piece of something that intrigues us in our research. I developed a course, a seminar class on animals in American history. And it was in teaching that class that I saw the need for a book like the one I'm currently writing.
And your tale of the miners really kind of capsulizes what is our sort of dichotomous relationship with animals. There are animals we love and animals we eat.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, there's so much richness and so much contradiction. And just sort of the whole range of human emotions and human capabilities, I think, are really, animals provide an ideal lens for thinking about these things across time.
When I think of animals in history in the West, anyway, I think iconic animals come immediately to mind: bison, wolves, mm-hmm. cattle, sheep.
Yeah, absolutely. And these iconic creatures, most of which are kind of, you know, fall into the category of charismatic megafauna. Not all of them, but most of them are charismatic megafauna. Those are certainly the easiest animals to research as a historian. And those are, you know, those creatures are going to be the main focus in this animal's history of the United States that I'm working on. But one of the things that I'm trying to do in the book is to think across the different kinds of categories that we humans impose upon animals. So to think about livestock and pets together, to think about working animals and companion animals and laboratory subjects. And so, you know, I mean, there's actually this sort of burgeoning field of animal studies and quite a lot of historical work on human-animal relationships, but a lot of it's been really narrow in terms of, you know, focusing on particular species or particular kinds of uses. And so, you know, I'm trying to kind of think outside the box and look at the larger connections and mm-hmm. the larger sets of relationships.
And are you looking at humans' effect on animals or the other, animals' effect on humans?
Both. I mean, yeah, that's what really, you know, as an environmental historian and, environmental history is really a field about relationships and about reciprocal relationships. And so I'm interested in how these effects work in both directions. And create, you know, sort of unexpected processes of change. So, in the case of something like horses, if you pick a, you know, very iconic creature in terms of Native American history, horses enable Native peoples in the 1600s and 1700s into the 1800s to revolutionize their lives in all sorts of important ways. But then the, you know, Indian use of horses then has all sorts of impacts on the horses themselves, from the creation of new breeds like the Appaloosa to the development of new economic relationships. You know, I mean, horses become sort of part of networks where captives and slaves are changing hands. You know, so I mean, these relationships are always working both ways, and there's really profound effects on human beings. But then in turn, animals are being transformed. They're suffering. Sometimes they're being, you know, sort of celebrated. They're you know, animals themselves are actually sort of enjoying new opportunities sometimes because of these historical processes.
Certainly aren't our attitudes about animals really totally driven by our environment? I mean, a Montana rancher's attitude versus an urban academic's attitude.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, to a large extent, these relationships are driven by our surroundings, by the sort of concrete experiences we have with these creatures. But one of the points I want to try to make in this book is that when we think about human-animal relationships, and in particular when we think about how we should relate to animals and what sorts of changes maybe we should make in our relationships with animals, that those aren't simply ethical questions, but that's actually a historical question, that we need to have some understanding of where our present-day relationships, where these contradictions, for instance, between, you know, the fact that we have one category of animals that we call pets and we often treat them like family members. We have another category of animals that we call livestock that at this point are sort of, you know, industrialized. And we feed one category of animal to the other category of animal. And I think we need to know more about how those systems, how those ideas, how those practices developed.
You do also draw parallels somewhat, at least explore the relationship of slavery and the treatment of Native Americans to our treatment of animals.
Yeah, well, in the case of slavery, you know, I think there's a very long history dating back actually to a lot of the early writings and speeches by African American fugitive slaves, critiquing slavery for treating people like animals. There's this longstanding tendency in sort of ethical debates to make this equation between slaves and animals. And in sort of present day discourse around things like, you know, veganism, for instance, oftentimes people today will point to slavery as an example of, you know, here's something that we used to do. We realized it was wrong. We abolished slavery. And so slavery often stands as kind of an example, a sort of object lesson to people in the animal rights movement. But what I'm actually more interested in is looking at how actual slaves and actual animals interacted. And I'm interested in trying to track this actually from the African origins of enslaved peoples in the New World all the way through emancipation.
And what are you finding?
Well, really, really fascinating stuff. I mean, animals are everywhere in history, of course. You know, and this is sort of one of the larger points of the book, right? As if we look around our world today, if we think about our own lives, animals are everywhere. But when you open most history textbooks, there's only a few places where animals really figure in any significant way. So in terms of slavery, you know, slaves are changing hands literally side by side with animals. They're on the same auction blocks oftentimes. They are, many, many slaves worked with draft animals in the fields, oxen, mules. But slaves also, you know, and I think a more interesting part of the story is that slaves often used animals to achieve some kind of autonomy within, you know, an incredibly oppressive system. So there's slaves actually owned animals, which was a contradiction in the Southern legal system. I mean, property can't own property, and yet many masters actually tolerated this system whereby slaves would keep their own chickens, often keep their own hogs. And then slaves who succeeded at poultrying and at hog raising often moved into owning larger animals, cattle, horses, mules. And some of them actually became quite entrepreneurial, even though they were still in bondage. And then when slaves ran away, which was sort of the major form of slave resistance in the United States, I would argue, there was this sort of back and forth where the master class would use horses and dogs to try to track slaves down. But then many slaves were able to use their own animals or their own knowledge of animals to get away and to survive while they were escaping.
The contradictions that we have in regards to our relationship to animals is something that the animal rights movement thinks we should resolve.
I don't think that, I mean, the contradictions are so many and they're so deeply entrenched that resolving them collectively I think is something that's sort of, you know, beyond beyond our capacity in the short term without major transformations in, you know, everything from our food systems to the ideas we carry around in our heads. I don't think these are contradictions that can actually be ironed out in any sort of, you know, period of decades even. Certainly individuals perhaps can try to resolve these contradictions in their own lives, but what sort of impact that has on larger systems sort of remains to be seen.
Great topic for a book, though.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of fun to research and to write.
Well, I look forward to reading it. I've been speaking with environmental historian Dr. Thomas Andrews, whose new book is called An Animal's History of the United States, A Work Still in Progress. Thanks very much for giving us a preview.
Oh, thank you.
Environmental historian Thomas Andrews will give a free public lecture tonight at 7 o'clock in room 106 of the Gallagher Business Building on the University of Montana campus.
And now for tonight's forecast. There is a winter storm watch in effect for tomorrow morning through Sunday afternoon for the West Glacier region, the Flathead and Mission Valleys, the Potomac Sealy Lake region, the Missoula and Bitterroot Valleys, the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains, the Butte and Blackfoot region, as well as along the Rocky Mountain front. West of the Divide, there is also a winter storm warning in effect from 11 a.m. tomorrow to 11 a.m. Sunday for the Kootenai-Kamnet region and the lower Clark Fork region. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows in the 20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and a slight chance of snow. High should be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there is a high wind warning in effect from 2 a.m. tonight to 9 p.m. tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain front. Tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 25 to 30 degrees. Expect wind gusts up to 65 miles per hour overnight. Tomorrow, there's a slight chance of snow with some areas of blowing snow in the afternoon. Expect highs of 40 to 45 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with isolated snow showers and lows in the 20s. Tomorrow calls for a slight chance of snow and highs 35 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Errol Rice.
The future of Montana family ranching is bright. Prices are good, new marketing opportunities continue to develop, and our sense of community remains strong throughout the state. Montana ranch families are working together for daily ranch activities, community leadership, and sharing ideas to continue improving their ranches. Younger generations are passionately returning to the ranch, often after earning degrees at Montana universities, to become a vital part of the family business. And what's great about that is that they are excited to do it. However, there continues to be challenges that we are eager to address, such as pressure from increasing urban expansion, risk of increasing government regulations, and a growing population that is less acquainted with how family ranchers continually evolve with the use of new technologies, resources, and adaptation to a growing global market. We also face pressures on the environmental and wildlife fronts that push for sustainability and greater access to learning more about how our beef is produced. Fortunately, leaders from the ranching community are working with Montanans to address those concerns. Our ranchers are progressive in their work, continually working to improve their ranching practices and striving to adapt to the changing environment society is bringing to the table. A great example of this leadership is the LaSalle Ranch of Haver, winners of the Environmental Stewardship Award. The LaSalle Ranch has partnered with the Montana Natural Resources Conservation Service, the Chippewa Cree Tribe's Natural Resource Department, and the Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation to implement conservation practices and a planned grazing system to protect environmentally sensitive areas on the ranch. They have installed over 7 miles of stock water pipelines, 25 wildlife-friendly watering facilities, and 10 miles of cross fences. A major focus of the LaSalle family efforts has been Beaver Creek, which flows into Beaver Creek County Park, the largest county park in the United States. This park is a very popular summer recreation area for Hill County and surrounding county residents who enjoy camping, swimming, fishing, and picnicking. The park is located on the downstream border of LaSalle's grazing allotment. the LaSalles have worked to keep cattle off the sensitive riparian areas of the creek by developing 8 off-stream water developments, utilizing solar energy to pump livestock water to higher elevations to take grazing pressure off riparian areas and allow even grazing use of the pastures, and installing 3.5 miles of riparian area protection fences. These efforts have resulted in improved water quality in the headwaters of this watershed and a more pleasant environment for recreationalists. Montana's ranching community is working to share their work with you. Follow the Montana Stock Growers Association Research, Education, and Endowment Foundation online through Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Pinterest, and others. We invite you to engage and share in the dialogue. In essence, we invite you to meet Montana ranchers, building the face of the ranching community.
Errol Rice is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.